Welcome to Between the Lines, an Oaks Church Brooklyn podcast where we go behind the scenes of our current series, The Story of God, alongside our pastors and a few friends. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome. We're back Between the Lines. It can be a bit of a hiatus, I would say.
Been a long time. Shouldn't have left you.
Palm Sunday, then Easter, but now we're back.
It was a really good, though, Easter season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very early.
Yeah.
I have a theory that the earlier Easter, the shorter the year. Because, especially for our line of work, Easter, it's like everything's kind of like slide into the rest of the year after Easter. When Easter's so early, it's like, all right, the year's pretty much over.
What else is there to do?
Yeah. But once you hit the holidays, it's pretty much, we're out of here.
That's it. It's over.
So, so happy 2025.
Happy New Year, man.
Yeah, good to see you.
But we are back with Between the Lines. And this past Sunday, we got to enter a new chapter, a waypoint, as we enter the story of the Exodus.
Chapter 3.
So we've moved from creation and fall, the covenant of Abraham, and now we are in Egypt and facing the story of the Exodus. And so, yeah, I just wanted to see where you're at. Like, how did you, as you were preparing for this, Patrick, come into this story? Like, where, how did you find yourself as you began to prepare for this?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There, you know, I mentioned on Sunday, none of us come into this story clean, meaning we bring in our history and histories and the stories we've told, the stories we've believed, the stories we've lived. And so obviously, like, as a Black American and we're entering this story into slavery, that forms so much of how I approach this, or how I think about this, or how, or what even resonates with me, right? And so, yeah, coming into this waypoint, entering back into the story here, we'll touch on it a little bit this week. I love what that phrase you've been saying in our meetings and stuff lately about how, where we left off at the end of Genesis, where Joseph has like established the people and they're really plentiful, and where we'll pick up is that, like, they've seen and understood that part of the covenantal promise where it's like, I'm going to make you a great nation. Like, they are great people, but there's that other half where I'm going to take you to a land that I'm going to show you. And I love how you phrase it there. The right people in the wrong land. And I don't know. I think that's really informed, like, how, even how I entered this waypoint, being like, what sense do you make of that? And particularly coming from the son of slaves who were in a good land and then became like the wrong people, you know, in the wrong land, and land and people and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't know. I could go on.
Yeah. I mean, if you can go on, I mean, I can imagine in preparing for a teaching on kind of like getting us ready for the Exodus narrative, that some things were sort of left on the cutting room floor. A few things you left, you had to, for the sake of time and expedience, let linger. So I wonder, yeah, I mean, like, you're speaking to some of these things around this kind of self-identification with this story, and you said you could go on. So I imagine if you could for a moment, what are those things that sort of got left behind as you were preparing this that you, man, you wish if you had an hour you could have brought in?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think here's kind of the irony of it. Everything I just said about how I am influenced by the history of slaving, enslavement in America. And yet, I also recognize that as a pastor there are people in those seats and people to whom I am parlaying kind of this ministry of the word, whom that isn't their story. And that's not the first thing that they think of. Yeah, yeah. And so it's like, okay, well, how do I address that? How do I actually not make this? How do I, this is a weird question. How do I make this slave story not so much about slavery?
Mm.
You know, like that yeah. was a really interesting thing. And do I have to? And do I, so what ended up on the floor was actually kind of just some stuff around like what it looked like for people to like live in the land. What were some of the kind of like the geopolitics of this region and what it meant for the Israelite people just to kind of flourish, you know? Like, it really felt kind of abrupt to jump straight into the slave narrative because where we left,
yeah,
there was plentiful. Like, they just got saved from a famine. And you don't really spend a ton of time, even in the text, with, like, they're flourishing.
Mm.
And so I had a call to that, and I was like, nah, let's just jump into it. And let's actually jump into the dissonance around passages like these.
Mm.
So that's where I started, you know, where I started with Dolores Williams and that quote. And
yeah.
Into a very long history retelling.
I mean, yeah, I think it's interesting. You kind of brought us into this sermon via the avenue of like hermeneutics. So like how do we actually interpret these stories? How do we actually make sense of them? Because we don't make sense of them in a bubble. They're reflective of our own social, cultural, historical location. Yeah. So I mean, that must have been, I could imagine that was a lot for people. To yeah. kind of get hit with. It was awesome as someone who's a bit of a nerd myself. But I can imagine if people sat there Sunday and said, huh, like, what do I take away from this in terms of this kind of hermeneutical history? What would you offer them?
Yeah. Well, a little inside baseball. I love when we talked after because, you know, we obviously debrief with each other.
Like, yeah.
How this go? And I remember you said, like, I don't know if you'd have, if I'd have gone so much into the like.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot how you say it. Like the, like kind of the, what is womanist theology?
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
all that kind of stuff. But it's like, but you were really cooking when you got into like.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of history lesson.
Get to the cooking. That was just my point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's exactly it. What are we cooking and who are we cooking for?
Yeah,
and
that's like, good.
And like the reason why I felt it was so necessary to go into that, starting with that womanist place, because you're talking about a story about a people who were once on top, but where we're entering, they're at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
This is a story about people at the bottom. And what does God do with and for and to people at the bottom?
Mm.
And what does he do for the people who have placed them there?
Mm.
And so it just made sense to me, you know, Malcolm X said that the most disrespected person in America is a black woman.
Yeah.
It made sense to me to start at the bottom societally and to say, like, here are the voice of women, these black women who have brought in their theology and their voice, and for them, this Bible, these stories don't read the same.
Mm.
And can we reckon with that? Right? Like, it seems inconsequential. And what's interesting, I think, I'll say this is maybe a little controversial, but I think it's the truth. We live in New York, right? Mm-hmm. The bastion of liberal democracy and liberal thought. And, you know, every time you turn on the TV, we're there's all this, you know, New York is so woke and you know, but we forget that, like, this is the place where Rikers Island exists.
Yeah.
Some of the most inhumane treatment of people in this country happens under democratic control and
yeah.
under the guise of, like, you know, those really thoughtful Democrats, and that's not a, I am getting political, just to say that there's this moral licensing that can happen because it feels like, oh, because I buy my coffee organic and fair trade, I have freed myself from being on the top of anyone.
Mm.
And so it just is interesting how, like, I think some of the things that resonated even in this Sunday was people were really excited about me going through this history of kind of like the moral majority. And though I wasn't trying to, I was just trying to give a plain telling of the facts. I wasn't trying to you know, make any qualitative statements on
sure
those beliefs or those actions. That part really resonated with people
because
it kind of felt like, oh man, yeah, you're pointing out those people. But the part that didn't really resonate, the part that was just like, the only people that really actually even acknowledged it, even in the hindsight of it, was literally Black women, was the voice of Dolores Williams, who looks at a passage and looks at the Exodus story and looks at the move into the promised land and goes, what do we make of these people that displace people? What do we make of this God that seemingly... gives the land of another to his people without seeming regard for those he displaces. We don't really want to talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you know, as you read that quote on Sunday, I think it's an interesting thing to nurse and to dwell on, because it's this reality of the messy reality of God acting in history. And so, yeah, I think we get caught up in the Exodus narrative on the liberation of the people, and then we don't actually think through really take time to think through what that means for these people already dwelling in the land of Canaan. And I think we can theologize our way out of that problem, and we can make some statements on the nature of their, that these are more so God displacing, not necessarily people, but like God, the gods of the Canaanites or whatever, but like that would still not actually speak to the full facts, which is God says, I will give you this land. And then he goes and names them.
Yeah.
He says, and it's someone else's land. I'm going to give it to you.
Say their names.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because as we kind of think about where we are and how we read this story, it's there's an interesting sort of parallel to like our current geopolitical reality.
Yeah, but okay, but I do want, I think we should bring this forward.
Yeah.
But before we do, I think it's worth saying, because I do recognize that for some people, this could be really destabilizing. And I just kind of, I don't want to alleviate anybody of that disruption. This should disrupt us.
Yeah.
Dolores Williams, I am thankful for her voice. I don't really actually agree with somewhat of what Dolores Williams kind of like espouses in her writing. Some of it, it's like, hits me wrong a little bit, but I'm thankful for it because she expands and brings necessary voice to the conversation, and particularly on behalf of people who, it's easy for me, even as a Black man, I still contain power and privilege.
Sure.
It's easy for me to have this moral licensing that says like, oh, not me. I live in New York City. Not me. I'm a Black man. I can't have it. There's no one under my boot. So I'm thankful for her voice. But the thing I wanted to hit on that was how we look at this. Who's telling the story and to whom is really going to influence how we receive it. And that was really the point I was trying to make on Sunday. And because whether you're taking Dolores Williams or Jerry Falwell Sr. and how they read passages like these, I don't know if it's so much that there's a right or wrong if you try to read backwards with our modern sensibilities.
Sure.
But I think if you think about an oppressed people, and like we talked about during when we were coming out of the Noahic covenant, and we were talking about genealogies and how genealogies kind of serve to order people and say this in-group and out-group and here's the people that God kind of, quote unquote, kind of favors. The reason why it's important that God names, I think, those tribes that are going to be displaced is because those are symbols or artifacts of oppressors of the Israelites.
Right, yeah.
And so how they're reading this and how they're receiving this is God is going to take up your cause and what your enemy has robbed from you, what the locusts have stolen from you, I will return. I will not let the people who have put their boot on your neck stand.
Right.
And you will actually plunder their spoils. There's this kind of cosmic justice bound in that, that when you think of it that way, you're like, oh, this totally flips the script, you know, of what God's doing here, which is typified, which is concretized in the story, spoiler alert, when they leave Egypt with their oppressor spoils.
Yeah.
Having taken their gold and their riches on their way out, this is what the Lord does. What they have meant for evil, I will intend for good. What they have stolen from you, I will return. That's the lesson.
Yeah, and even I think about that, there's something about I find fascinating. If for me, if I was kind of like sitting in this text for this Sunday, throughout the rest of the biblical narrative, as we will discover, Yahweh, it kind of his title is Yahweh, the God who rescued you from Egypt.
Yes.
It becomes this idea that or whenever they get commandments or God Yahweh asks them to do something, it's because remember you were once slaves in Egypt.
Yeah.
And so this idea of like, I think for me, if I was sitting with this, is this founding narrative for the people of ancient Israel was so pinnacle, and yet we notice throughout the entire narrative the greatest accusation against them that they keep forgetting it.
Yep.
And it has all these ramifications. And so for me, if I was sitting with this text, I think, yeah, how it would have entered in would be like the importance of founding stories and what happens when we forget them.
Yeah. It's funny, something you talk about, like, that was left on the cutting room floor. I think if I, one thing I would have added, if I would have said, it's important to track, you know, it's funny how you take stories, and I feel like we can adapt a moral from a story before we actually, like, take it to its full implications. So, like, for those who kind of look and say, like, oh, once I'm out of, like, God's going to take up my cause and he's going to give me all the power. Like, that's kind of what we want.
Yeah.
But here, you're seeing what happens with people in power and how they use it. And there's this this rapper, Sho Baraka. He has this wonderful line in one of his songs. He says, do I really want peace or do I want power so I can try it?
Right.
And I think what we'll see as we go through, we follow the story of the Israelite people, is there's this constant, there's this flip-flopping. Like, they have power, and then they don't have power. What do they do when they are in power?
Right.
What do they do when they are under power? And that's the way, like, you know, we kind of move us a little forward to kind of modern day. The reality is, in this country, founded on and really fortified by the transatlantic slave trade and the systemic oppression of black bodies and brown bodies and bodies of color across its history, the reality is that sociologists tell us that there is a dramatic shift, and that by 2050, black and brown people of color in this society will be the majority, right? They will have the power. I think that speaks to a lot of the kind of like replacement theory kind of anxieties and fears that's happening in our culture right now. But the question will become, when people of color are the majority in this country, how will they lead? Will they use the oppressor's tools? Will they choose something else, right? will there be room for people they consider dangerous? That's how the Israelites ended up oppressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. The people
Pharaoh like, yeah, feared them.
Yeah. Yeah. He felt like these people are dangerous. So what do we do with the dangerous people when we're in power and we have the ability to, in our own power, make them dangerous? Who will we turn to and who will be our strength even when we are strong? And like that's, man, that there's a, I don't know, there was a quote from Thomas Jefferson that I almost started with. And he says, indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. Like, Thomas
ironic.
Jefferson, yeah, right?
Yeah.
A man who won't sleep, but he, and if you read a lot of Thomas Jefferson's writings, over and over again, he's like, dude, we're,
yeah,
we're in trouble, bro.
Yeah, like, we bit like, it. Yeah.
Like we're in trouble. There's a reason they cut out Exodus out of the slave Bibles. I think partly to try to keep the slaves in line, and partly to mute their own existential anxieties about a God who does who eventually
a God who frees slaves
hears the cries of yeah. his people. So anyway,
yeah. Man, that's a lot, and I would love. That's yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. We could have like a follow up podcast and all that. But you did mention as we think about bringing it forward.
Yeah.
And you know, because obviously, the great Christian claims that these stories have meaning for us today, like you said, and I think in the sermon, right, the Bible's not written to you, but it is written for you. You mentioned something in your teaching about like there's this kind of two visions of empire and Jesus as this third way. And I wonder, as you reflect back on that, what lingers for you as people are trying to live this third way?
Interesting question. A good one. So I think when we talk about Jesus as this kind of third way, one of my sources by the Walton Brothers, I'll read a quote for it. I just found this really fascinating. It said, remember when I was talking about goodness and this kind of, on Sunday, I was talking about this concept of like, how do we relate to these stories? Like, and you have to be careful when you read backwards that you don't just like take, like you just draw kind of like principles like, oh, God's trying to make us good Israelites, or God's trying to make Israelites good Americans. And so there's this danger. You can read something in the Bible and go, oh, because God used that, I can now use that.
Yeah.
And that's his determinant of goodness. But in this text, it says something that says that God does not tell us how or expect us to produce goodness. That God does not tell us how or expect us to produce goodness does not therefore mean that goodness has nothing to do with us. We already understand this basic idea in the context of salvation. If we want to be saved, we have to make specific adjustments to our thoughts and behaviors, but those thoughts and behaviors do not themselves produce our salvation.
Mm-hmm.
Christ's death and resurrection does that. I love this. Furthermore, the Bible does not tell us what particular actions we have to take. We draw our understanding of these from our own religious traditions. The text does not specify anything beyond a generic belief in the Lord Jesus, as Acts 16, and baptism of water in the Spirit, John 3. It provides no specific creed or catechism and does not specify infant baptism, believer's baptism, the sinner's prayer, or any other particular action. It certainly does not tell us that if we want to be saved, we should do what Christ did. God does not tell us how to produce our own salvation. Instead, he tells us how we can participate in the salvation that he produced. Goodness works the same way. We talk about Jesus as the third way. That's what's so interesting, is that everything is mapped onto Jesus.
Yeah.
And so we're not, every Christian is not actually called to go get on a cross, to sell everything, to become itinerant rabbis.
Right.
Get on a cross, get murdered. Like, that's actually not the call.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's the call.
Yeah.
Right? It's to be formed in this way by moving in under the Spirit and surrendering our lives in such a way to the influence and the power of the Spirit that the Spirit then leads us in how, because that's the work of Jesus. How was Jesus empowered? Jesus acted and moved through communion with the Father, being led and empowered by the Spirit. So if you want to do what Jesus did, speaking to my 16-year-old self, that was like, I'm selling all my stuff. I'm like starting to wear rainbow sandals was like the hit in South Carolina. I don't know if you guys know about rainbow, but it was like, I got my flip flops. I want to just start like, you know, bucking the system. And it's like, nah, just, could you give yourself to the Spirit of God? Can you be obedient to the Father? And in that, can you just like let your salvation be born out of you? I am enslaved by so many things, and the pathway to freedom won't be found in my might, because I don't have any to overcome the Egypts of my life. And my salvation won't be found in my schemes and imagination. But where will my help come from? It will come from a God who would tell me, stay ready. Identify with me. Put the blood over your door so that I'll know that you are mine. Identify with me. And then go to a land that I will show you. Not going to tell you the directions, but I'm going to show it to you. I'm going to walk with you there. And so then the question becomes, am I willing to do that, or is it better for me to stay in bondage?
No, it's so as I sit with that and I just think about the story of Israel as it relates to the story, as if we've mapped that story onto the journey of the spiritual journey, there is this great irony that Israel cannot save itself, nor can we save ourselves. But the one thing they can do is participate in the salvation of others. Because that is their point, right?
Yeah.
I will make you a blessing to all the nations.
Yeah.
And so there's a great thing, the great call of Jesus, yeah, you can't save yourself. So you need not use the tools of empire to try to maintain your security and safety. But you can participate in the liberation and salvation of others.
Yes. And so when you, I love that point, because when you look at what's happening in that same region today, I think that without Jesus, who frees us from the needs of the material world, but also allows us to interact with the material world in a way, right? So he frees us from a geography, because by his Spirit now, we don't need a particular land. We won't need a temple. We won't need a tabernacle. We won't need an Ark of the Covenant. That's in us. We can go anywhere. We can be anywhere. But without Jesus, what we have left are artifacts and symbols. We have our salvation that's founded in geographical boundaries, that's founded on mountaintops where we build our temples. And so you can understand the desperation then and what people are willing to do to be connected to God. And we'll see man's inhumanity to man. How ironic that how inhumane we will be in our quest to be divine. But with Jesus, the incarnation, the divinity puts on humanity, and as such frees us then from the bondage of this material world that it now then allows us to live in the material world. To actually live in the day-to-day. We have to do things. We have to take up space.
Well, we can live freely.
Yeah, but we can live truly free
yeah.
no matter where we are, no matter what we have.
That's good. I mean, with that said, I can imagine as we go through the rest of this series, some resources will be helpful. So, yeah Patrick, what are your resources you're bringing to the table today?
Ooh, I think in that spirit of like, examining our lens, a book I love is Esau McCulley's Reading While Black. particularly chapter two, where he talks about like policing through the lens of like the Exodus story. And I would encourage anyone to read it, if only to just come in. Esau McCulley's not trying to speak for all Black people and how they read the Bible. What he's really trying to do is to do this like kind of an exploration of hermeneutics and to kind of give us and free us to say, like, what is the lens that you're reading the Bible in? So I would just really encourage people to like go check and see how he does that, and then ask yourself those questions. What about you?
Yeah, so there's a Jewish scholar, Gary Rendsburg. I think I brought him before, but he has this great small article on framing the story of Exodus as Yahweh's kind of war against like the Egyptian sun god Ra. And I think to your point on Sunday, these are the categories ancient peoples are thinking, and they're thinking in terms of gods and celestial battles. And so he kind of talks about how there's some interesting etymological work happening in Exodus that clearly frames that this is not just between Moses and Pharaoh, but this is Yahweh judging the Egyptian sun god Ra. Very interesting stuff.
I love it. Send me that link.
Got you.
All right. Well, friends.
Between the Lines.
Just Between the Lines. See you next week.